celebrating the fusion of culture and creativity. Welcome to Ocupación. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Ocupación. I hope that you're having a beautiful day. I hope you're having an excellent week. I send you a big hug. I know that life can be a lot right now, everybody. So I send you hellos, and I want to point out that we do have a new town that is listening to Ocupación that we have to welcome and we have to shout out and celebrate. So Skokie, Illinois, which is a village in Cook County. Hi, welcome. We are so happy that you're a part of this family, that you're a part of Ocupación. Welcome, Skokie, Illinois. I spent some time checking out what you look like, checking out some of the ground photos, and I was pleasantly surprised, really beautiful, and I hope to visit one day. So, welcome. All right, what have I been up to? What have I been doing? How have I been feeling? I've been feeling okay. I've been keeping up my spirits. I ended up telling myself that this year my resolution was going to be to do less and to relax more and have more quiet time. But actually, it's like someone asked me to do the opposite, because what I've been doing is being more productive and doing more things and waking up earlier and staying up later and having insane thoughts all night. So that's what I've been up to. And I'm actually finding it really helpful. I'm finding this like special music on YouTube that's helping me to focus and not have so many creative thoughts all day that keep me from finishing my work. So I've been doing that. But for inspiration and for joy, it has been all over the place. And I want to share a few things with you that I've done that have been really fun and really fulfilling and really lovely. So I went to Griffith Park Observatory. You know, this is a remarkable place. If you've never been to the Griffith Park Observatory, it is worth a visit. This place is remarkable. It's, you know, beautiful from an architectural perspective, from if you're interested in cities, right? If you're interested in urban planning, just being able to see how the city is spread out and sprawling and what it looks like with all the nature around it and all the buildings and different city centers and all of that. You can also see giant telescopes and all kinds of really interesting things like Tesla coils, stuff like that. And one thing that you can do is you can watch these films that they have that are in, they're shown in this like dome planetarium. So you've probably been to a planetarium before, but if you've never been to one, let me describe it. You walk into this big room and there's a giant dome above you, and then you sit on these chairs kind of like a movie theater, but they lay all the way back. So you're laying down and then you look up and you see this big open kind of concave dome. And then you can choose what you want to watch. And what I selected was this film called Signs of Life. Man, it was awesome. If you listen to the show, then you're probably aware that I love science and I really enjoy talking about the universe, thinking about the universe. All of that is of interest to me. So this was really about a lot of topics, not just astronomy. A lot of things go on in this show. For instance, one of the things that happens is that they take you through this world where you get to see a microbial world and what's going on in your body and what all these microbes are doing, like running around in the single-celled atoms within them. And then all of a sudden, it pulls out of that, you know, tiny microscale, and it goes into this huge scale where you're thinking about, you know, billions of light years away, and showing some of the photographs that we have from all of these different space telescopes and rovers and things, and learning primarily about what it might be like to search for life and on different planets and different moons and things like that. And then they talk to you about which moons they think are most likely to have life based on some of the different conditions. And what's really cool, my favorite part of this, which just like was awesome, is that they imagine what an alien civilization or what alien plants might look like based on some of the environmental factors of this place. So if the place like is really far from the sun, for example, and then that would maybe impact the way that the creature's eyes look or the creature's skin looks, or, you know, the way they would absorb sunlight. And so maybe they're neon colored and so on. And so they had these designers kind of infer what these life, what these living things, these organisms might look like. So it was all really fascinating and interesting, and I loved every moment of it, and I want to go back, and that's all I want to watch. And I want, it's all I want to think about, and it's all I want to read right now, and it's all I want to listen to podcasts about. So kind of, you know, have to relax a little bit because I do have other life that needs to be lived, but that was really cool. And then, you know, if you think about that as like something that is intellectually stimulating, I did something that was like kind of the opposite, which was just silly for silliness' sake. I had such a good time. I have to talk to you guys about this. And I hope that some of you appreciate this, especially if you're into films. So I have this really good friend who likes to watch a lot of like B-rate movies and old school horror films and kind of obscure films from the past, you know, kind of interesting futuristic films from different countries. I mean, this person is very eclectic in their taste of film. So, you know, needless to say, anytime there's a recommendation, I'm in, even, you know, even if it's not quite up my alley. And this time they had tickets that they couldn't use because they weren't feeling well. And so I scored these tickets last minute to go to the New Beverly Theater and watch a double feature. And I didn't even know what the double feature was, in all honesty. I just kind of wanted to go and have a night like that in a nice theater and invite some friends and just sit around being open to whatever it was. So of course, you know, not to be, you know, too on point, but I was late because I'm always late and that's a problem. But I get there and I miss the first movie and I realize the first film is Gremlins 2. So I'm like, all right, I remember Gremlins from when I was a kid. No, you know, no harm. And then I just go into the theater to see what the second film is. And the second film is this film called Freaked, which was shot in 35 millimeter, or at least it was presented in 35 millimeter at the New Beverly. I didn't know anything about this movie. Nothing. I had never heard of it. I had no context. I didn't know. I kind of thought like, okay, it's being paired with Gremlins 2. So I could kind of expect that it might be comedic at, you know, but I didn't have anything. I didn't expect anything. And so I'm watching this movie and it is like insane. It was an insane film. If you've seen this, you're probably laughing right now because you know what I mean. If you haven't seen this, I don't even know if I should tell you to go look it up, but it was fascinating. It was kind of like, you know, had this 90s vibe to it. There was like kind of like that Gremlins look to some of it, with the costume design and some of the effects, which still remarkably hold up. And there was also like, I don't know if it was claymation, but that's what it looked like. And the premise is that these folks, it's super silly. These folks go to like a freak show and there's this like evil guy who's running the freak show and he turns people who visit into freaks and they now, you know, have to be in this place. And in like what is considered a freak there is just like somebody that has like these like non-human qualities. And so like, for instance, there's this character who's a bookworm and he goes to this freak show and he gets turned into literally a worm. And so it's just, you know, hilarity ensues. There's a lot of like the comic timing is interesting and kind of in the style of Airplane, you know, almost like a Don't Call Me Shirley kind of vibe, which is really interesting. And there's like a secret guest, like Keanu Reeves is in this film. And actually, if you're a Bill and Ted fan, you know, both Bill and Ted, those actors are both in this film. And it's written in this really silly way. So I'm watching this film and I'm like, am I going to make it through this? I don't know if this is my vibe. And then I just let myself enjoy it. And I was just hysterically laughing. It was so ridiculous and fun. And I got out being like really inspired by how this film was even put together and thought through. And I spent, you know, 3 to 4 days sending memes to my friends from the film we had watched. So it was really fun and kind of a reminder that even if something isn't exactly what you would choose, different art forms can really bring out something different in you and give you life. So it was great. And special thank you to my friend Bruno, who kind of provided these tickets last minute and gave me this really cool experience. Okay, who do we have on the show? Who are we listening to today? If you are interested in food in any way, if you like cooking, if you like eating, if you are interested in plant-based chefs, then this is for you. We're interviewing Jocelyn Ramirez, and she's a published cookbook author, New York Times recipe contributor, a yogi, an entrepreneur, and she really advocates for healthy food access in her community. She's also the founder of Todo Verde, one of LA's acclaimed plant-based Mexican food businesses. The mission is to create delicious and healthy plant-based food inspired by her roots. She left a degree and a career in higher education to pursue this new path in cultural foodways. And we talk about a lot of things here. She's really interesting to speak to, really cool, and actually inspired me. And if you listen to the show, you know that I'm hopeless with cooking, but she inspired me to give it a shot and start to try to make something. And her first cookbook is called La Vida Verde, which is plant-based Mexican cooking with sort of authentic flavor. It was an instant bestseller. And then we talked about this product line that she has of culturally relevant seasonings, in carnitas, al pastor, tinga, all the things. And we talk a little bit about all of the knowledge that she has on healthy living, on building community and supporting communities through workshops, through dialogue, through food demonstrations, and most of all, just the creativity that comes with cooking your own food and making your own creations and your own dishes and what that is. So I'm really excited for you to listen, for you to get excited about cooking, about sustainable food and about plant-based eating in general, even if it's not something that you're doing on a consistent basis, considering it as part of your repertoire of cuisines, right? And maybe there's something there for us to enjoy. So I look forward to hearing what you have to say. And without further ado, this is my interview with Jocelyn Ramirez. Enjoy, everybody. It's with great pleasure that I welcome Jocelyn Ramirez to Ocupacion. How are you doing, Jocelyn?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me.
It's so nice that you're here, you know, talking about food and cooking. These are my favorite episodes. I just love it. And I think people really enjoy it. So it's such a pleasure that you're here. Why don't you start us off by introducing yourself to the audience?
My name is Jocelyn Ramirez. I'm a plant-based chef in the Los Angeles area. And I have really evolved in the food space over the last decade, from local farmers market pop-up to now focusing on a product line that's in grocery stores. And I've done anything and everything in between, from catering Super Bowl to catering baby showers to you name it. I've probably done it. I've done food at a major concert venue here in LA. So, you know, I've definitely found different creative ways to play with food in a way that makes sense with my cultural background and the way I grew up around it.
Yeah, let's start there. Let's start talking about how you grew up. Tell me a little bit about the stage. What can we imagine? Where did you grow up? And what were the things that you saw around you that led you to be interested in food?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in Southeast Los Angeles, specifically in Southgate here in LA. And really, my food connection began with going to my grandmother's house in Canoga Park at the time. She was a matriarch of the family and really gathered the family around food. It was this convivio of whether it was just our immediate family going to visit or 40 people going to visit. It was always this act of preparing, serving food that was so intriguing to me, and the flavor profiles and the fact that you can cook for two people or you can cook for 50 and the flavor is always on point, and it was filled with so much love. And so that was really my initial introduction to food. And she knew what each one of her grandkids' favorite dishes were. So if I was coming over, she knew to make my sopa de fideo, even if it was just like literally just a couple bowls worth of sopa de fideo. If my brother was coming, it was sopa de fideo and his chile de huache. She knew how to kind of, make these special dishes for each one of these people she really cared about. And that was really, really a beautiful gesture to me. You know, we didn't come from a lot in our family, but that was the way that we honored each other, loved each other. And you know, it's great to continue to do that in my everyday life.
Yeah, I really connect to that. It was a very similar experience in my household. We're Guatemalan, and so the food was very vastly different than the food that was in my neighborhood. And so I got to learn a lot about the culture that maybe wasn't right in front of me through the act of kind of sharing food. I'm curious at what point you started to get more involved in food making in your household.
It wasn't until I was probably a young teenager that I started to try to explore dishes at home. And, you know, another big point of inspiration for me was watching cooking shows. So, you know, I had this like very niche, like style of understanding food through my grandmother's lens, through my mother's lens, which is from Zacatecas, Mexico, like that style of food. But then, you know, to turn on PBS and watch this white guy, Rick Bayless, make, all these different dishes from different regions of Mexico, and to see him in those places and at the markets and trying food, that was new information for me. It was like a different lens to see Mexico through that I wasn't familiar with. So that became like a big point of inspiration where I started trying to cook things at home. I was watching the Food Network and I played around with like baking cakes and things like that. So if it was like a celebration, I was like, oh, I'll make a cake, and was just really trying to learn these techniques that I could see chefs on TV doing that I can then translate to my silly little dishes at home as a young teenager.
You know, I have a confession for you. I actually can't cook at all.
Oh, no.
And what's interesting about it is that, you know, I do find it interesting and I do try, but there's this incredible fear that I have around creating something that isn't just palatable to me, but that is palatable for other people, because everybody has, you know, different things that they like. There is this fear around getting it right. Tell me about how you discovered that you had this capacity to kind of share this with others and that it was good.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think for me, it is a lot of that, right? Like you want to make sure that other people enjoy it, especially now coming at food with the lens of like a plant-based diet. So I'm trying to recreate the dishes that my abuelita would make for us that I grew up eating, but now it's plant-based, and are people going to like it? And if they don't like it, I'm definitely going to create a divide where they don't want me to bring that dish or they don't want me to cook. So it was definitely a little bit of that. I wouldn't say fear. It was a little bit of like I'm exploring, give me a chance. If it's not great, I'll make it over and over until it's great. I remember there was one year where I made a bunch of pies and I really was wanting to incorporate amaranth in everything I was doing that holiday season. And I overdid it with the amaranth, and literally each pie tasted like dirt almost. And my family was like, what? Like, what are you doing? Just buy a pie at Costco. And I was like, no, like it's just my opportunity to explore and play with these ingredients that I want to know more about, that there's a disconnect from culturally. So, you know, it's interesting. It's like trying to now get to a place where, like, for me, it's all about bold flavors. Like, people have told me your food tastes really rich. You know, you try it and you're just like, whoa, what is that? It's really delicious. And so for me, it's like adding above and beyond, and it's not for everybody. Like, I have some people who are like, it's a little too much. It's a little too spicy. It's a little too, and I get that it's not for everyone. And that's just something that I've had to come to terms with, is that, you know, if I have 10 people trying it, if at least 7 of the people love it, I'm good.
Yeah, I'd like to talk a little bit more about play in general, because a lot of mm-hmm. times when I interview and I speak to people that are creative and that are really passionate about what they do, play is such a clear element of the creative process. Walk mm-hmm. us through that process. Tell us a little bit about how you develop a dish.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, because I'm constantly developing dishes for my platform, other platforms. I'm working on a second cookbook right now. And it comes from a series of different inspirations. Sometimes it'll be an ingredient that I see, whether at the farmer's market or my local grocery store, that I'm not super familiar with. And I'm just like, oh, I don't really understand what this is. Like, let me check it out. Let me buy it and I'll try it raw, and I'll figure out, like, if I do this with it, maybe I can figure it out, or I'll check recipes online to see how are other people exploring it. And then I'll try to figure out, like, how does this make sense with my kind of eye on ingredients that I use on a regular basis. So it is a lot of like, randomness of like, I just want to explore something new and figure out if I can use it in a cuisine that I'm already familiar with, or if I have to just go off and try to play with a cuisine that I'm not so familiar with, which I do at home, right? Like, I love Asian flavors, and so I love exploring that at home.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because when you were speaking, my first thought was thinking about Asian food, thinking particularly, there's someone that I follow online that kind of walks you through traditional Chinese cooking. Mm-hmm. And watching the way that she so freely kind of, you know, really not measuring, just sort of like freely inspired in creating. I went back to my kitchen and tried to do the same thing with what I had in the fridge. And one thing that led me to was understanding the importance of balancing flavors.
Oh, absolutely. Right?
Even yeah. when you're trying to make something bold, tell me a little bit about how you even figure out what that balance looks like for you.
Yeah. I mean, there is a lot of play on like, I mean, there's a book called Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, right? And she doesn't really mean it in the flavor components of it. She means like the actual ways in which you use those elements to cook. But that's Samin Nosrat, who wrote that book. But for me, it's all about like, how do I get something to touch your tongue and really coat the palate and stand out? And sometimes you taste something and it's like, oh, it's a little too acidic. If I only added a little bit of sweetness, just enough to kind of skew that flavor a little bit, it will hit your palate in a slightly different way. So it is a little bit of like playing with like, what could this use? Like, not necessarily that it's missing something, but if it had a little touch of this, it would just like knock it out of the park, you know? And so a lot of it's scent based. A lot of it is just like, okay, you're painting a portrait and it's just missing a little bit. Like, it's fine. The portrait can go on the wall without it, but it just needs a little bit of something else just to get it like perfect, or as perfect as can be. And like an art piece, always evolving. I mean, even I'm sure like many abuelitas, not just mine, they, you know, like you're playing with it and you can make it every single day, but it's every single day, it might be slightly different than the day prior. It could be that the acidity of the tomatoes is slightly different today than it was yesterday. They're more ripe and sweet today. And that kind of changes the balance of the flavors. But I love just kind of figuring out how to do that kind of on a whim, like how you were saying, just using your hands to measure and just taking in the scent, tasting, and oh, it needs a little bit of this and that. The tricky part is when you actually develop recipes for a living and you're documenting them, there's that component of like, I have to weigh everything. I weigh it in ounces. I weigh it in grams. I have to use measuring spoons. I have to put it in a measuring cup. Everything has to be documented. And that sometimes feels a bit daunting. It makes the process longer. And even though it's still a creative process, it also feels like it takes away a little bit of that, like, kind of like on a whim creative process, because it's like, oh, okay, let me do the calculation on this. If I add one more tablespoon, then the weight is going to change, you know? And so it's just a little bit of a different type of energy when you're doing that. And I can't talk to people when I'm in the process of developing a recipe. Like if I'm just home and cooking and my husband's here and we're talking, that's one thing, I'm cooking dinner. But if I'm developing a recipe, I'm like, I'm not available for the next hour and a half. Like, please don't ask me any questions, because you're so focused in on it in a different way.
Yeah. And it's like all your senses are focused in it, right? Mm-hmm. Because you're talking about being able to smell it and taste it and see the richness of the colors and also experience it, right? Because you're fully immersed in this world of cooking and focusing on it. It's really interesting. I'd like to stick with that analogy of the painted piece. Yeah. Let's talk about, you know, if we were talking about a painting, I might ask you, What is your signature style? Tell me a little bit about what those signature flavors are for you. When somebody comes to eat what you've made, what is the flavor profile they can expect?
Yeah, I mean, I am known for my love of cumin. I go a little heavy-handed with the cumin for anything that I'm using as sort of a meat replacement, if I'm using jackfruit or mushrooms. I love that accent of it. I feel like it's a nice foundation of flavor for me. And then I also like to use a lot of ingredients that you wouldn't be able to point out if you tried something, unless your palate was really, really refined and can catch it. But I love using all things mushrooms, paste, powders, grinding them, you know, just using them in all different ways to amplify that flavor. And then there's also other umami things that you can use, like a liquid aminos or a soy sauce or tamari or tomato paste or nutritional yeast. There's a series of different things that you can use to build flavor, and you can try something and you would never immediately think, oh, this has soy sauce, this has liquid aminos in it, but it has a little something back there that tastes good. And that's what that is. So I love kind of playing with that. Like miso is another great example of that. Like adding a little miso even to a saute or to some sort of a marinade is going to add a nice depth of flavor, a nice salinity to it. So I wouldn't say that those are like, maybe not like a signature, because people don't really know exactly what it is. They can't put their finger on the nose or whatever the term is. But they taste that there's some good foundational flavors there. And the other thing I will say too is that in my cookbook and a lot of my cooking over the years and catering with Todo Verde, I am known for not using onion and garlic. I do use it, you know, here and there, but people are shocked at the fact that I don't depend on onion and garlic to build flavor in my dishes typically. They are really thrown off by that. And there's so many other ways to build flavor aside from those two ingredients.
Wow, that's really interesting. Really fascinating. I'd like to let's go back and talk a little bit about your first time on hearing the word vegan, seeing a vegan dish, tasting a vegan dish. Tell me about that, because for folks that are maybe a little bit younger than me, maybe this has been a part of your whole existence, your understanding of the world. But for me, I didn't hear the word vegan until I was 14 years old. And I saw it for the first time really watching Anthony Bourdain travel around the world, mm-hmm. And talking about some of these dishes that didn't have any meat in them. And I didn't try my first dish until I was already well into my teens. So I'd love to hear from you. How did you come into the awareness of this world?
Yeah, I initially, probably similar age to you, maybe in my early teens or something, I went to a family party and there were the two people who were there, not too far off in age than I was, just a little bit older, who were both vegan. And they were only eating rice and beans at the event that we were at, the gathering that we were at. And I was really curious about it. Why is that all you eat typically? You know, how often are you just eating rice and beans? Like, just wrapping my head around it. And I learned, I mean, again, I was at a young age, but I learned that there were really great, significant reasons why somebody would choose to eat a diet that didn't depend on animals or creatures. And I've always been an animal lover. In fact, when I was younger, I wanted to be a veterinarian because I just have always had this deep love of animals. And so that was kind of my first initial opening to the idea that somebody could choose to live a life and survive and get all their nutrients and, you know, be healthy eating in a way that didn't depend on animals. And so at that young age, I started looking into PETA and looking online at products that didn't harm animals. So I learned about the fact that, you know, there's cruelty-free products out there. There's a lot of brands that still test on animals. So I had this little notebook that I would carry around where I would write down, you know, when I go to the drugstore to buy my makeup, don't buy from these brands. These brands are okay, at a very young age. But to stick to the vegan diet, that was a really, you know, from that point where I initially learned about it till my late 20s, which is where I really fully adopted that lifestyle, it was hard. You know, I followed folks like Anthony Bourdain, Jonathan Gold here in LA. I wanted to eat all of the things. If somebody told me, oh, that there's this eyeball taco and a pig ear this and a, what, you know, I was there eating those things. You know, my favorite tacos were tacos de tripas. I loved menudo, you know, like, and when I decided to lean into this plant-based lifestyle, my friends and family thought I was crazy because they thought I was the last person that they would ever see adopting that type of diet. But it really came because of the fact that I was dealing with health issues at a very young age. I was dealing with a thyroid issue, something I still monitor to this day. I didn't feel well after eating a meat that was predominantly meat-based or animal-based. I just didn't feel good or satisfied. I felt like my body was a little bit off and tired and just not great. And my family was also dealing with a lot of preventable health issues. So for me, I started to kind of think about, all right, like, this food should be fuel to live, not bogging me down, not creating diseases and health issues. So I started to inquire further and kind of think a little bit more critically about the food that I was eating and consuming and that my family collectively was eating. You know, they say diabetes is hereditary. Yes, but it's also the lifestyle that's hereditary. You're living this lifestyle that continues on. It's a cycle. And ultimately, I feel like that's a big part of the reason why some of these preventable health issues carry on from generation to generation. It's lifestyle, it's food, it's so much more than just your genetic DNA or your makeup. And so I attended this Indigenous veganism workshop as I was kind of trying to learn a little bit more about the decolonial foodways movement, what true ancestral food look like for somebody who's Mexican Ecuadorian. More information is out there, definitely for you know, Mexican cultural food backgrounds. And so that day, going to that workshop, I went from, you know, about a year's time of being vegetarian to ultimately taking the leap to be full on plant based. And it's been a process. It is a process. And I think people think, oh, I can just like flip a switch, and some people can, and that's great. But for many people, it could be a 15-year process of learning about something and then figuring it out as you go. It's definitely not linear.
Yeah. And even just having access to the food, I think, is really important to discuss. For instance, some of the first vegan food that I had was what I think a lot of people started with, which was South Asian cuisine. Mm-hmm, a lot of Indian food or East Asian cuisine, let's say Thai food, for example. And so the idea of transferring those plant-based ideas to a Mexican or indigenous cuisine, I'm curious about how you were able to make that happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is a lot of cross-cultural influences amongst our cuisines, right? Like because of the spice trade, like we didn't have Ceylon cinnamon. We have it in everything. We didn't have cilantro. Folks didn't have tomatoes. They didn't have vanilla. They didn't have, you know, so all these things really created this like really beautiful interconnectedness that even though our cuisines are distinct, there is this sense of interconnectedness amongst, you know, so many different cultures globally. But I mean, when you talk about like Thai food, for example, it's so bold and delicious, and the freshness, like, I mean, when you try their larb dishes, for example, like you can't not think about ceviche. There's just like these really distinct flavor profiles that just go hand in hand, yet they're very, you know, one's larb and you know one's ceviche, but they're still a little like they're primos hermanos. There's something going on here, you know? And I love that. I love exploring those flavor profiles and seeing like, oh, what if I added a little vegan fish sauce to this? How would that change this Mexican iconic dish and give it maybe a little bit of spin that feels like it's coming from, you know, an Asian profile? So I love kind of thinking about how you can continue to evolve cuisine in a way that still respects it, that still honors it. Because when people today argue that this is true traditional Mexican food, my carne asada and my pork menudo or my pork pozole and my beef tamales, this is true traditional food, true traditional Mexican food, and you cannot explore that further. Punto. Ya se acabó. This is it. I like to push back on that because we didn't have pork, we didn't have chicken, we didn't have beef, we didn't have access to lard and all these things in ancestral times. And there were tamales and there was pozole and there were all these dishes that, you know, there was no carne asada because there was no beef, you know? So those are newer traditions that have evolved post-colonization. And so to say it ends there is not really fair. I mean, if you're saying that that's the tradition, then look at the true traditions and like, that's the way that we should be eating and it should stop there. So it's kind of, this conversation that continues to evolve, but you have to really think about it in a way that doesn't dilute the culture, that doesn't disrespect any other cultural backgrounds, right? That you're still honoring the true ways, but figuring like, how else could I, kind of play with this in a new way. Like I just created a dish that I haven't really talked about publicly too much yet because no one else has done this dish. And I'm just like, should I ask New York Times to post it or something? So it's just out there. But it would be like a new dish that is playing a little bit of a riff with these Thai flavors that is Mexican.
Oh, well, we're on the edge of our seats and we want to know. And hopefully when this comes out, it's out. Yeah. It's out and I can taste it.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about how you're able to include the community and what you're doing and sort of this mission that you're crafting to access plant-forward food, culturally rich and significant food. Walk us through the process of creating Todo Verde.
Yeah, I mean, initially when I started Todo Verde as more of a food service hospitality business, I wanted to just be able to say, hey, here is this nostalgic dish that we grew up eating that had all these animal products in it. How do you like this new version of it or this updated version or my version of it that is all plant-based? And getting that into the hands of people, having them try it and seeing how many people were blown away by it. I have so many people that I think the number one line is, if I could eat this way every day, I would go plant-based, which is how the cookbook emerged. You know, okay, like here are the recipes. all right, like, how do we get this, you know, to be simplified even more? Here's some seasoning. Just add it to XYZ plant-based ingredient and you're done. You have Beckles. But really the mission continues to try to encourage people to explore what plant-based could look like in more of their regular lifestyle. And I always tell people, I'm not trying to get you. I mean, if you decide that you want to be 100% plant-based, amazing. That would be great. Even if I could get you to be 50-50, 75-25, that's a win for me. Even if it's just a couple days a week where you're exploring plant-based a little bit more, that's a huge win compared to where we are now in the whole animal agriculture system and the ways that we eat. But I continue to do work in the community by going to local schools, churches, whether it's in person, virtually, and having conversations around what a plant-based lifestyle could look like. I was just at a church a couple weeks ago with this young adult program where they're learning a lot of life skills. And I talked about Ayurveda. I talked about the food system, what's really organic, non-GMO, you know, just really getting folks to kind of think about food a little bit more critically, because the reality is, like, when we're in a food desert or area of a city that doesn't have a lot of options and the McDonald's is there or the other fast food chain is there and you're hungry and it's cheap and it's fast, it's hard. It's hard to really say, no, I'm going to choose to eat a healthier way or a plant-based way or a seasonal kind of lifestyle, you know, or to really make all my food from scratch. And sometimes it's having those kind of deeper conversations and seeing where folks are at and seeing where I can meet folks and have those conversations and seeing if there's any way to change their perception about what a plant-based lifestyle could look like. So that's something that I do constantly. I would say several times a month, I'm doing sort of that community impact work with different community partners.
Wow. And for folks that have never really engaged with Todo Verde, what can they expect if they're going on your website and they go on your platform and they want to access maybe a cookbook, maybe they want to see where they can try your food? What would you say that they can expect from Todo Verde?
They can expect to find different recipes available on my website, on the blog, on social media. I'm constantly trying to put recipes out there for people to explore. They can absolutely find the where to find the seasoning or purchase it online so that they can easily try it at home. So I would say the big thing is probably just looking and testing out the recipes that I have available on the blog and on socials.
I'm curious, for folks that want to make that leap from, let's say, being enthusiastic about cooking to becoming chefs and really honing in on the craft, what would you say to somebody like that who's just starting out?
I would say that it is being a chef, especially in the food industry at a restaurant, is a lot of work. Being a caterer, it's a lot of work. I don't think people understand how truly physically taxing it is on the body to prepare food for so many people. Standing long hours, just the pace of it, the heat, the danger, the literal danger of it. And I'm not trying to say to folks to not explore that if that's your passion. However, I always encourage folks to stage at some kitchens, reach out, see if you can work a few days and kind of understand how that kitchen works, what the staff is like. Anthony Bourdain, who you mentioned earlier, he used to be a big proponent of people not paying for culinary school, which I agree with. I think that that's a huge expense and burden to put on people, where if you have the will and the way to get into some of these kitchen spaces and you really want to hustle and learn and, you know, spend time in these spaces and go above and beyond, you can get a great deal out of, you know, hustling in a kitchen or kitchens, as opposed to, you know, paying to go to through a culinary program. So there's different routes, but I would say to someone that you really have to be passionate about it. You have to really want it. I mean, I did hospitality service for the last decade. And I was going to open a restaurant as I transitioned out of the last kitchen that I was in, the last quarter of last year. And I was kind of a little bit out of a crossroads. You know, I feel a little bit older. I feel a little tired. The pandemic really kicked a lot of us around. It's been tough, and I decided to take a pause. I still have that aspiration of a restaurant for myself, but I also felt like it doesn't have to be right in this moment in time, because just lots of transition. My father was passing away. I was spending more time with family. It just didn't feel like the right timing for me. And your heart really does have to be in it, because it's all you're doing all day long. So it's a lot of work. There's this show called The Bear. I had nothing to do with that show, The Bear, but I always mention it to people to watch, because I think that that's the truest depiction that I've seen of folks in the restaurant industry, the chaos of it sometimes. Even when you think, oh, we're going to be good. Service, we prepped everything we need for service and we're all good. And then somebody calls out, or more people show up than expected. One of your POS systems breaks down. There's always something. We thought we had that pot of something cooked, and guess what? It burned. There's always something that throws you for a loop and and leaves you kind of like hanging on for dear life till the end of service. It's pretty crazy.
Jocelyn, what has it meant for you to be able to kind of pursue this passion? What has it meant for you to live a creative life?
For me, it's been so impactful and important in my personal journey, just because I've always been a creative person. Since I was a young kid, I've always had that outlet of art, right? Physical art. I remember I used to draw and paint and do all these things. And my dad signed me up for this program that I begged him to sign me up for, where I would, they would send me artwork and I had to recreate it and draw it. And then I'd mail it back in and get a grade. And it was this whole thing. And so I've always had this passion of design, of art, of, you know, and to do it through a culinary space just really ties it together for me, because I've always been so passionate about food since a young age. And I didn't think that it could be a career path. I didn't think that I could do this for a living. I just thought it was this hobby, this passion that wouldn't amount to, you know, getting paid for my labor to do those things that I care about truly. So for me, it's something that when I wake up in the morning, I'm excited about it. You know, I'm already thinking I want to do this and that. And honestly, it gives me a little bit of anxiety because I want to just hurry up and do it. But it's just when you have that finished dish, for example, like I have a recipe that I tested about 3 or 4 times. One of the times I got sick because I was like, I'm going to try raw mushrooms. Got sick. All right. I'm better. My stomach is good. Let me do it again, you know? And then I made it a couple weeks ago and I was trying it. And my husband's like, what do you think? How is it? And I was like, this is it. 10 out of 10. If I went to a restaurant and I ate this, I would be like, God damn, I'm coming back to this restaurant. This is the dish. No changes, you know? And it felt so good. It felt so good to like get it to a place. And I, you know, I had other people try it and they're like, this is great. It's so fun to do that you could just put these things together. You have your own little method of doing it, and it brings joy to people. That's a beautiful place to be able to create and do that, and to make a living doing that.
Jocelyn, for those people that are listening who want to check out the cookbook, they want to follow Todo Verde, where can they find you?
They can find Todo Verde at Todo Verde on any social media platforms, or Todo Verde LA. If they want to grab the cookbook, it's available everywhere books are sold. Highly encourage folks buying from my website, todoverde.org, for signed copies. You can get the seasoning there as well.
What is the cookbook called?
It's called La Vida Verde. It's got 60 plant-based Mexican recipes.
Thank you so much, Jocelyn, for being here and for sharing your wisdom with us.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a lot of fun. Thank you for letting me share.